If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Podcast. With me today is Murray Dahm, Mark McCaffrey, Mike Cole, Mark DeSantis, Lindsay Powell, and my name is Jasper Oorthuis. I'm the editor of Ancient Warfare Magazine. And today we are going to talk about the latest issue, which is issue 15 to the Batavian Revolt. Finally, we return to my home country. Although I have no claim to this being descended from Batavians, but yeah, that's a whole different story. And we have a couple of questions from patrons and others who, which we probably can use as a guide to get us talking. And the first one is maybe nice. There is some irritation going on between the Batavians and the regular legionaries. And why is that? Asks Jared on Patreon. Mark, I think you addressed that a little bit in the issue. Could you illuminate that for us?
Well, in terms of the legions in question, it's really the 14th Legion, which they're sort of paired with from there, where we sort of pick up about the Batavians being involved in Britain, and you've got them going across there in AD 43 paired with them. So they've got a bit of a history with that legion over in Britannia. And then, of course, when they sort of moved out of Britannia in about 66, 67, this is under Nero, of course, thinking that he's going to launch some sort of Caucasian expedition of some description, although it's sort of, there's an alternative explanation in one of the sources. But whatever he had in mind never actually eventuated. The two forces, the Batavian cohorts, which had been used in Britannia, along with the 14th, ended up traveling halfway across Europe, ending up somewhere in the Balkans region, and they're basically halting. Now, somewhere along the road, their love story ends, it would seem. There doesn't seem to be any indication of that there's animosity between the two groups up until that point, but at some point that split does happen. I mean, this is all happening in the middle of civil war period in Rome. I mean, you've got this the breakout of war during Nero's reign, at the end of Nero's reign. Of course, Nero's death, you know, really kicks that off. And of course, the Batavians, I sort of hesitate to sort of lay the blame for the revolt in the end on the Batavians, because the Batavians are really just another group getting caught up in picking which side to go on to. So they sort of, you know, once they sort of get caught up by Nero actually recalling them back from wherever they were heading, back to Italy, of course, they sort of get back towards Italy. And, of course, Nero's death ends that sort of situation, because by the time they are heading up towards Gaul to deal with Windex, they then decide that they're actually going to switch sides. They're going to go onto Windex's side, and the legion that they're traveling with decides that they're going to stay loyal. So they end up splitting up and going their separate ways. The two continue to have animosity, because in the next year or so, when they're sort of going about, you know, on the one hand, the Batavian units take Windex's side, but of course he ends up dead. So they subsequently turn onto Galba's side, because he decides that they can, you know, he can use them potentially for his own means and use their previous loyalty to Windex to his advantage up in the northwest. But then, of course, he ends up dead. They decide to turn against whoever's going to kill him. So therefore, they think that actually Vitellius, who they previously didn't like, actually their enemy's enemy is their friend. So therefore, they'll go onto his side as well. But, you know, in the end, they end up at Bedriacum before the first battle. And, of course, this is where they start developing a reputation for themselves. They are, you know, throwing their weight around in the face of the legionaries. There's a suggestion that maybe they should be sent home before the battle, because actually they're causing more trouble in the camp than they're worth. But on the other hand, the legionaries get wind of this and say, actually, we hate them, but we love them at the same time. We need them. What are you doing? Sending our best auxiliary troops away just before the eve of battle. They stick around. They play a decent part in the battle. And then afterwards, somebody, some bright spark says, well, we've got, after the Battle of Bedri Akum 1, we've got a whole bunch of, units from both sides who we need to disperse. And of course, you end up with the legionaries back with Batavians being quartered in a city that's modern Turin. And of course, you then have them getting at each other's nerves again and ending up not just at loggerheads, but actually physically, a pitched battle at each other, just about, only to be dispersed by two Praetorian Guard units getting involved. In the end, I mean, there's the animosity that comes to the fore, but actually what causes all this in the first place is difficult to, nobody actually says this is what, this is what's causing it. But
I think it's the British influence. I think, they're basically like British soccer hooligans. So they've been in Britain and then they go on tour to the Balkans and Italy. And they end up in a drunken brawl between the Batavians and the 14th Legion. And it's broken up by the Praetorian Guard, who take the legionaries' side. And that really makes the Batavians get.
So who are the hooligans here? The legionaries or the Batavians?
Both. Well, they're both. It's like the UEFA.
I wouldn't deny that Dutch British teams on tour and they get it. Yeah.
Legionaries aren't really in the clear here. I think the legionaries, but the Batavians are the small guys here. They're sort of, who's been leaning on who all the time in Britannia, all the time we've sort of moving around Europe. Actually, you legionaries are, really,
So can I say, let's bring this to order and be sensible. So I'm going to throw this in. I think the clue to understanding the source of this animosity is actually in Tacitus Germania 29. And if I read, it says here, it tells us about them. They still retain an honorable privilege in token of their ancient alliance with us. They are not subjected to the indignity of tribute or ground down by the tax gatherer. Free from imposts and special levies and reserved for employment in battle, they are like weapons and armor only to be used in war. And I think what that means is that these are not your regular auxiliary troops. They are special. And I think that the legionary would probably tend to look down their nose at the auxiliaries. And I think there are examples in early imperial history where there is friction, and that's something that really causes resentment on the auxiliary side. But for these troops who think of themselves as an elite, and to add a footnote to this as well, they were actually, in a sense, they are the clients of the emperor, to the extent that, for example, when Drusus is leading his campaign, he is their patron, effectively. This is what I understand. So they have a very unusual relationship. So to be treated the same as other auxiliaries, that's going to be a source of friction and contention.
I mean, they're physically, they're marked out, because if you think of, a lot of auxiliaries sort of taking on, Roman weaponry and whatnot, these guys are clearly marked out. They're using their own kit. They're not, bowing down to being just subsumed under the name auxiliaries. And even later on, when you start thinking about the rebellion and when you look at how the Batavian cohorts, when they actually turn and go against Roman forces, they are more, more equal to Roman legionaries than any other auxiliaries you might really think of.
If I could build on that point, that's an excellent point. The Batavian cohorts were, I think, the elite of all of the auxilia, and were in every meaningful way, the equal of legionaries in combat capability. What we find is that once they eight Batavian cohorts, the ones that became notable for what they did later during the rebellion, when they separated from 14th Gemina, they marched north, and when they came to Bonn, they came upon the first Germanica Legion, which had about 3,000 troops, which were supported by Belgic auxiliaries and a large number of civilians that thought apparently that they were going to overwhelm the smaller number of Batavian auxiliaries. But what Tacitus says is that all the Batavians wanted was just safe passage past Bonn, but the first Germanica Legion was not going to allow that. The Batavians organized themselves into columns for all around protection and just rolled over the relatively thin line of the more numerous Romans and pushed the Roman legion back into their camp at Bonn. They dispersed the Belgic auxiliaries. And I think what this the event at Bonn proved, it was over relatively quickly, this battle, is that the Batavians had the discipline, the same sort of discipline that Roman legionaries had, plus they had that toughness, that Germanic toughness, made them fantastic soldiers. And then we see them later on, after they had simply moved on because they wanted safe passage, when they joined Civilis, they were given the responsibilities of overseeing the siege engines and the defenses of the siege of and the siege works of Vetera. So alongside the Romans, they had acquired at least some knowledge of Roman siege craft, which I think made them especially effective.
That's a little bit, I'd argue that it's not a good one to judge their strength by the situation, but actually, a lot of these conflicts that we're talking about in terms of the Batavian Revolt, where we're talking about legionary forces, you've got to think that legions across Europe had been thinned by what had been taking place in terms of vexillations being taken out of there for the Civil War battles. And for example, the first legion at Bonn, we're told that that was actually, one, under strength, two, full of new recruits who were gung-ho and wanting to prove themselves. So, I mean, I don't disagree that the Batavians are an elite unit and something that is, as you say, akin to legions. But I think, this was probably overkill in terms of, they literally that statement of just don't come out against us. You don't want to, and they do say, we are Roman, loyal Roman allies. You don't want to come against us. We've got grievances and, you just best leave alone. But I think it's judging the situation that they did actually say that message.
And I want to throw a flag on the Germanic toughness notion, Mark. A great point, but I think we can all agree that German troops were neither tougher nor neither more tough nor less tough than any other. I think it depended on the, certainly they were
perceived. There's a book in that.
But want to make sure that was stated.
It's also interesting that the line versus column argument is normally reserved for the Napoleonic Wars, but here we are several centuries.
Well, so in that, Murray, I see the same principle as increased depth phalanxes in the Hellenistic and Greek world, right? It's an effort to break a line. And by the way, this is something, we were talking before the show started recording that I've been thinking about the 17th century a lot for other research. And this is an argument that's even occurring there, like the Dutch versus Swedish decisions to deploy in less ranks or more. And it's sort of a race between envelopment and punching power, and also benefits to morale from when people waver in the front of a. So I think that's probably what's meant by column, is my guess.
So is it true then, Mike, that your next book is actually going to be called "The Iron Lie Shattering the Myth of the German War"?
How many medals are there? The gold lie.
I have to sell it first. Yeah.
Okay. Well, can we spread the plugs over the whole episode, please?
Yeah. I was going to say, it's interesting because when the battle at Vetera is fought, which is in the issue, the Batavians are in three columns again to attack the armies that go against them. So it's maybe that's a Batavian thing. We don't.
As I say, it sounds like it's doctrinal.
So, but maybe back to the question. So there is animosity, and going back to sort of the because we have several questions that to try and get make a sense of what is the origin of this revolt. And there's Mark just explained one side of it. The other side is what happens in the Batavian homelands, the Insula Batavorum, which is the area between the the Waal, Rhine branches, and the Meuse River in the Netherlands. So if you look at that, there's, again, it's explaining the issue. There are local grievances, and two, there's basically just one, and that is goes back to what Lindsay mentioned. The Batavians are allies of Rome who do not pay taxes, but they deliver troops for the Roman war machines, to put it that way. And I think it's suspected. I mean, as far as we know of the total population of Batavians of this tribe and the number of troops that they delivered to Rome, 9 cohorts and an ala, a cavalry unit, that is a very high population pressure. And then comes the civil war, and the Romans go, we want some more. And the local commander who takes up this recruitment effort does it in the most brutal way. And that sparks, that seems to be sort of like, you know, there is sort of the underlying pressure, and then there's a spark and it goes kaboom. Is that fair to say that, put it that way? So how does, I mean, we all know that Tacitus' history is, you know, it's about three things. It's the Batavian revolt, it's the revolt in Judea, and it's the civil war of AD 69. How, you know, can Abram on Patreon ask, is it possible to compare, of course, Tacitus does this, native revolts, the Romans just had a revolt in Britain. You have the Batavian revolt in the Low Countries because it spreads, and then there's the Jewish revolt. How does that, you know, compare? Is that the local cultures trying to push back to Roman dominance, or is there something else going on, or is it different?
I actually have an add-on question, which I think it's for everybody, but I think it's primarily maybe for Lindsay, and that it dovetails into this. Sorry to put you on the spot, Lindsay. So one of the things I think that is notable about Rome's early success from the dominance of the peninsula is the abstraction of loyalty to the idea of civitas, right? Like certainly that exists in the Greek world, but this idea that there's a loyalty to an abstract notion of statehood that erodes, right? Erodes maybe beginning in the conflict between Marius and Sulla, and that erosion can ultimately be tracked to a breakdown in adherence to the notion of Roman identity, which allows someone, if you're a Batavian or a German or a, you know, a Thracian or whatever, to be like, well, you know, maybe that isn't important. Whereas if you're a legionary with Latin associations and this idea of Latin supremacy, you're going to be punished by the Vitus Latini. You have a different set of expectations. So my question then is there a breakdown due to the Civil War and the abstraction of loyalty from the concept of civitas to the concept of an individual, which we see happening right in this period? And is that creating different expectations about who's in charge and who should be in charge between someone who's a legionary and someone who's in an ala? And is that also driving the animosity? And that applies not just to this revolt, but it would apply to all three as per Abram's question.
It's about five questions.
Yeah, just start somewhere, Lindsay, and we'll try to see how it goes.
Well, let me see if I can throw in some things. Stream of consciousness, so that there's kind of some disjointed thinking here. But I think it comes down to each of these conflicts is unique in many respects. So if you look at this one where we're talking about sort of Batavian conflict, my understanding is it's mainly a military conflict around one individual, as opposed to, for example, I'm thinking of some of the other conflicts that might have been, you know, you could think of the Boudiccan Revolt, you can think about Bar Kokhba, you can think about the First Jewish War, which seem to be more, there's a larger civilian component to the distress. And I think what makes the Batavian one interesting is it goes back to, ironically, to what I said earlier about Tacitus' point is these people are allies, right? That they're not really subject peoples and they're not conquered. So there is a different expectation about that. So the if you were to make a comparison between, for example, like we mentioned Bar Kokhba, is the assumption there is that Judea, the district within Judea, the province, that it's a Roman dominion and has already been for many generations. That's not the case as happens to the area of the island of the Batavi or the Canaan Fatis or any of those people. So when they're badly treated, it's sort of like a treaty violation as much as anything else. So I think they can feel they're aggrieved and they should be able to find a recourse to it. And I guess what's happening is that their voice is not heard. The difference is when you become a subject of Roman Imperium, It's different because there, some part of your population is a citizen and they are protected by the laws of the state and all the rest that goes with being a kivis, as opposed to other people who may not be. And it's when Romans treat subject peoples very heavy-handedly is where you get the frictions and the problems. I'm thinking, for example, of the Batonian revolt in AD 6, which, interestingly enough, was something that was almost incidental. What happened there was that Tiberius was leading a campaign against Maroboduus over in the sort of Danube region, what we now consider to be Bohemia. And apparently what was happening is that the Illyrian cohorts were being gathered in Illyricum. And as the story goes, they began to realize how many of them there were. They hadn't, because they'd been dispersed and they were being gathered to head north across the river. And as the story goes, and I think it's Tacitus probably, if not Cassius Dio, who basically makes the point that they realize, what are we actually here for, to defend their position or our position? And these two leaders of the Boraeci and the Dizidiates basically decide that this is their moment to break with Rome. Now, they're assumed to be subject peoples, and in fact, they're in the employ of the Roman army at that point as well. So there's a number of violations going on here, and they break into revolt. And of course, this means that the campaign destined to happen against Maroboduus is quietly or quickly abandoned. They sign another treaty with Maroboduus, a sort of humiliating one, in order to turn tail, come back across the river. And for 4 years, Tiberius and his armies, conglomerations of units from different provinces, come together and gradually overcome them. But that one seems to be, again, a sort of militarily incited one. But in the text, what you get there is the sense that I think there's a line which I'm struggling to remember exactly, but it goes something like this, is that you need to treat us like a flock of sheep and shear us just enough, not basically slaughter us, which is what indicates that the Romans in certain provinces have not yet mastered the art of that gentle touch. And they do the same thing with, for example, Boudicca and famously the rape of the daughters and all the rest of it, and De Niro and so forth. So I think these things are very context, very historical in the sense of that they have unique sets of circumstances. But at high level, you can derive from that certainly in the early empire, that Romans are pretty heavy-handed in many of the geographies. And there are pressures amongst the people to resist those pressures, not necessarily to oust the Romans completely. They just want to be treated fairly. And by the time you get to Hadrian and Bar Kokhba, for example, there was also a revolt in Britain at the same time. So even under Hadrian, things weren't terribly satisfactory for all the populations living within their boundaries.
I agree with all that, but I think there's the one difference for the Batavii is that from my reading of it, I don't get the sense that they are really serious about breaking away from the Romans and cutting free. They want their existing deal to stand. They've got no problem with that. And whereas the Illyrians are going for, we could actually make something of ourselves here and whatnot.
Well, that was my point. So on the one hand, you've got a group who have the status of honored allies, and the Romans, in fact, piss all over it, if I can say that on public radio, as it were. And on the other hand, you've got the Illyrians, who are assumed to be, and actually this is one of many times, that the whole area of Illyricum had been the subject of wars continuously from Caesar's time all the way through the Octavian before Augustus, as it were. And finally, the way that Tiberius dealt with that situation was effectively they divide Illyricum into two, into Dalmatia and Pannonia, because they realize you've got to micromanage it much more effectively. And that seems to be, from that point on, they start subdividing territories all over the place. So by the time you get to Hadrian, you have all these inferior and superior and all these other combinations. And that seems to be the Romans' answer. We'll just have more administration. We'll keep closer check on them.
The interesting thing for a lot of these revolts is the combination of either mistreatment. So when you look at Boudicca's revolt and when you look at the Jewish revolt and even the Batavian revolt, it's about mistreatment. But at the same time, it's about opportunity, which comes through uncertainty in Rome about the leadership. And that plays its part in most revolts. At the beginning of Marcus Aurelius's reign, there's revolts everywhere because, who's going to take over after Antoninus Pius? And so what you find is as the year of 68 rolls on, and then 69, you start to get, firstly, Vindex. I can't bring myself to call him Windex. It just sounds wrong. It sounds like he's a cleaning product rather than a rebel. And then you get the civilist revolt, which does look to be opportunism. It's taking advantage of all of these mistreatment, you know, but there's several Batavians who don't know about the mistreatment, and they find out about the mistreatment, and then they sign on to the revolt, which doesn't really have any purpose. And then when you have, you know, the breakaway empire, after Vindex fails, there's a second breakaway empire that Civilis doesn't sign up to. So that's the sort of, what are we rebelling for? What's the purpose? And I think one of the great mysteries and disappointments of the holy account is that Tacitus breaks off just before the end of the revolt. We don't know what happens to Civilis. We don't know what happens to, you know, the Batavi, other than they continue to serve, they continue to be honored, they seem to continue to have tax exemptions. So almost like, okay, let's forget all, it never happened.
Not just the Batavia either, it's their allies as well. They also, you know, the Tungri, they continue to be great Roman allies for the next 100 years. They're brilliant. And
it's almost like we'll just pretend it never happened.
But clearly that makes it, the outcome sort of says a lot about what happened. I mean, if you compare that to the Jewish revolt that gets, you know, the siege of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and, you know, I mean, Batavodorum gets burnt down, but clearly after that, the relationship is recovered and indeed reset to a certain degree.
Well, and this does happen. So I mentioned the Batonian revolt, the Illyrican revolt, if you will, of 69. As that ends up with the surrender of Bato, and in fact, what's very interesting is that the way that the Romans would normally display their trophy is through a triumph and say, look what we've done. But in fact, what Tiberius says is that you've surrendered to me. You've actually been a decent sort. And in fact, we're going to take care of you. And in fact, a lot of these people end up in places like Ravenna, you know, as sort of they're thought of being worthy adversaries. And therefore, what they'll do is there's a certain element of what I think you said is that they restore the relationship because you all have to get along, right? And I think what was interesting in the case of the Jewish revolt, the first Jewish war, is, as you said, I mean, it was in a sense, it was a revolt in extremis. I mean, the fact that they actually obliterated the most sacred symbol of Judaism in Jerusalem was it even a deliberate act? I think it was actually accidental that they burnt it down. But the point is, it happened, and there was this terrible destruction of the city. And ironically, you go fast forward another 70 years when Hadrian decides he's going to rebuild it, and therefore he causes another revolt, because in fact that's considered a slight amongst other factors potentially against the Jews. So in the game, we come back to this not quite understanding the people that we rule as subjects. And I sometimes wonder whether that's partly down to the fact that that there probably wasn't any education in terms of sociology and geography of the peoples that they rule. It's interesting when you read Strabo, for example, or you read in Germania, these are attempts to try and explain the world for the Romans in Italy.
I think by someone who possibly never was there. But
yes. You know me. Yeah, and Yona makes the point, doesn't he, that, you know, it sets up a sort of straw man of something that isn't quite real, but it plays to the home audience, and he's trying to make another point about it. These are free people. They're noble savages, and they should be respected. In fact, like our ancestors were, and that's his real point in a sense.
Actually, even the the identity of the Batavia, it's interesting. They keep getting their identity itself just keeps changing. Are they Gauls? Are they Germani? Depends on, you know, which scenario you're talking about, which context in terms of where are they serving, which unit are you talking about? Are you talking about the German Guard in Rome, which in actually is mostly Batavia probably, or are you talking about the cohorts? With, you know, it's the labels and the identities get shifted around.
Well, but that's also because we are still stuck with the Caesarian split of, you know, left of the Rhine, that's Gauls, right of the Rhine, that's Germans. And then the Batavians have awkwardly managed to sit themselves right on top of it on both sides of the Rhine. So there, they can go either way.
It's also interesting because, you know, we get the focus on the Batavian revolt and the Jewish revolt. There are other revolts that are a sentence or a word in a source. That's it, you know, two words. So, you know, when Mucianus is marching the vexillations from Judea to Italy in 69, there's a revolt in Dacia. And there's a brief sentence which says he turned aside to put down an invasion over the Danube by the Dacians. And you're like, what? Oh, that's it. That's all we get. there's a false Nero who appears in the province of Asia. Again, a sentence saying, oh, there was a false Nero. He turned up saying he was Nero and got lots of support.
To that point, that Roman history is filled with that. So, for example, Cassius Dio mentions that when I did my book, Augustus at War, and that's basically the period 31 to 14, BC AD, it's that there's a line where he basically says, oh, lots of wars happened this year, too many to mention, not very important, next. and you're thinking, hold on, I'm a military historian, I have to account for all of these things. What do you mean?
Yeah, and it's not just Roman history, I'd like to add. It's the entire Mediterranean basin throughout the entire ancient world, and actually probably even into the medieval world as well. There's tons of stuff like this, and it's impossible to tell, does this mean that these things are insignificant? Does it mean that there are sources that have been lost? Like, this is a constant thing.
Well, I mean, the most fascinating one to do with the Batavian Revolt for me is Julius Sabinus, who goes into hiding under his burned-out house for 9 years. You know, he lives under there with his wife, Eponina, and they have children, and she goes around the town mourning, pretending to be a widow. Meanwhile, in the basement under their house, they're living a life. And she gets, you know, found out 9 years later. And of course, by that point, most of the sources are lost. And we sort of get anecdotes of what happens to Eponina. My favorite thing about her, of course, is she becomes incredibly famous for standing up to the emperor in court. And in the 19th century in France, that then gets taken on as a really important thing. And that's where the name Eponine, for those of you who are Les Miserables fans, that's where Eponine comes from, because it's
everybody's riding their hobby horse today. What's...
I know, just amazing.
Well, in the meantime, actually, partially you, Murray, have answered several questions that were on the list, such as what were the political aims? Well, we doesn't seem to have been independence. So let me see what's left now.
I will just throw this in as in the way that Mike did, a sort of follow-up question, is that the Bar Kokhba revolt was about independence. So that maybe is exceptional to all the other revolts that we're talking about.
But we're talking about the Bar Kokhba revolt in a month.
Yeah, I know, but I just wanted to make the point, though, that we shouldn't get the impression that none of these revolts were actually done without a political dimension. There is at least one, and arguably the first Jewish war was also about that same thing. It's just that, and to the point where they're overstriking Roman coins and they're actually declaring for the freedom of Jerusalem or Israel or whatever it is. So
the interesting thing about the Batavian revolt, of course, is that we don't know. The sources are, you know, there's the claim, for instance, that Civilis in the Batavian revolt was acting on behalf of Vespasian. No modern authority believes that. They think that's a pretext. They think that that's a falsehood, that's a forged letter. When it's, you know, Vespasian is now in power, they keep revolting. So you're like, well, hang on a minute.
Well, no, they don't. It's not instigated by the Batavians from the point that Vespasian's really, you know, sending his own man in when he's sending Petilius Cerealis in. That's the cleanup operation. It's not, you know.
But the pretext is there that they are doing this at a time when
do we have a Batavi source? I don't think we do.
No.
So, that's important, right? Like, that's important for this is the whole basis for, sorry for the constant plugs, but it's the whole basis for the Bronze Lie. We don't have a Spartan source. And I think this is also common when you try to assess, like, I've been writing recently on Brennus and the Gallic invasion in 3rd century BC, the forcing of Thermopylae. Like, we don't have a source from there. So everything we're doing is necessarily othered, and that's a
fact. Well, at least for the Batavian revolt, that information about the size of the population compared to the number of units that they delivered, that is archaeological research that they have a pretty good idea how big the tribe would have been. So they can corroborate at least some of it, but you know, there's no internal source from the Somersault's best.
You're speculating on political and cultural motivations for the revolt. You're speculating on the reasons for animosity between legionary troops and Batavian auxiliaries. Like that, I think, to make any kind of real firm ground to stand on, we would need a Batavian source, or preferably several Batavian sources, right?
Does Tacitus quote from the letter?
Yes, he names the guy who actually carried or wrote the letter on behalf of Vespasian.
Okay, well, that's...
So, But again, that's, you know, he's making that it's in the speech where he actually is announcing it to his own troops and saying, this is why we've got to actually swear allegiance to Vespasian, because we're on his side in the civil war. But, you know, so is that, you know, how legit is that? But on the other hand, you know, Vespasian's been active in Britannia at the same time as the Batavii have been over there. Batavii normally led by... It's a different legion, but, you know, in terms of, you know, vexillations and whatnot moving around, who's to say that, you know, we haven't got the detail to actually rule it out, have we? And, of course, you know, at the same time, if you've got Vespasian possibly getting involved, if you've got, you know, Cerialis, you know, coming in, and I would argue that in terms of how it ends, you know, that little scene, okay, it's a lovely little scene of them sitting on the broken bridge with Cerialis on one side and Cavillus, and, you know, them looking at each other. But, you know, are they, you know, are we trying to say here that they've got a past relationship from action in Britannia? Or, you know, again, we can't rule anything out, can we?
I wonder, some of these might be dramatic tropes, if you like, that Tacitus is. So, for example, I'm thinking Arminius and his brother Flavus. They're on the opposite sides of the river, and the one basically is, you know, throwing barbs and so on. The other one, like, you betrayed us, and blah, blah, blah. So, but it's a wonderful, like you said, it's a dramatic little scene, and for the reader or the hearer, you've got this little
piece. You wonder how much was misheard. You'll pay taxes. No taxes. Excellent. No.
But, you know, it's from, if you look at, yeah, the Tacitus describes these things all wonderfully, but, you know, it makes, whether there's a letter or not, I'm sure it was not, you know, not inconvenient for Vespasian to have a big revolt in sort of the background of while Vitellius was trying to be emperor in Rome. That's something for him to worry about while he was marshaling his armies to come west. That makes complete sense. So, and if there were agents or, you know, centurions that maybe served in for Vespasian that happened to be in the area, that there's stuff going on. That,
you could easily write an anti-Vespasian version where he foments the revolt and then he abandons Civilis. Go, now I've got power now. I'm coming after.
But you can make it into a whole play. I mean, you can say, look, that, as we said, there's a population pressure of how many recruits they have to deliver. They have a reasonable grievance. That is not something that is a very sexy story. So Tacitus puts up, well, you know, that they just adds in some incidents to give hold a on. Reason.
Have you read about Petilius Cerialis and his, you know, what's that? They've just floated away with my flagship and half my fleet. And sorry, I'm in the bed of a local Gallic woman who.
Ubian, come on. It's an
Ubian. Sorry, Ubian, yeah. Sorry.
I'm just
Ubian.
Saying for the causes of where does the revolt come from? And then it's handy for Vespasian, and then maybe if it's really a thing, Vespasian sends a very large army north, 9 legions, to subdue the revolt. And maybe it's for the Batavians to be able to go, okay, you know, that's enough. We made our point, and now we can go back to, you know.
To be fair, is he actually send? I mean, you know, it is the largest number of legions ever, you know, up until that time under one commander, but they're not all in the one spot. They never are. It's more like a cleanup of the Western provinces rather than necessary, you know, just Batavii.
There's more than one commander, but Petilius Cerialis gets all the, you know, Annius Gallus gets no attention, and Domitian gets omitted by Tacitus, but Domitian's clearly commanding as well
because all kinds of interests going on.
It's really like I like that you're calling Tacitus sexy history because that's normally Suetonius, yeah. Not Tacitus. But
Procopius.
Procopius, secret history. Whoa. And of course, the great thing about Procopius is you have his history of the wars where certain things happen, and then he recovers the same material in the secret history, and you're like, wait, hang on a minute.
Buildings.
That's
buildings.
The same person. On buildings, absolutely. But the interesting thing is Tacitus, you know, with the speeches, with the letters, there's clearly things going on, but some of it may have been invented to tell his version of events. because at the same time we have glimpses from Dio Cassius and other sources, even Marshall and, you know, these other comments that tell us a different version of what's going on. And we're stuck with the same old problem that the sources don't survive for us to be able to definitively say what happened or what didn't.
So one of the last questions I think that we didn't sort of answer in a by the way kind of way, which revolt was more dangerous to Rome, the Batavian revolt or the Arminian revolt? Which is qualify what makes it most dangerous, but you know, this is a nice forum question.
I would say neither, because neither one was planning on invading Italy and taking over the Roman Empire. Worst case scenario, you're not going to come and take their territory. You know, worst case scenario is the Batavi establish a Batavian homeland, which we don't even know that that was their intention. Arminius, you know, keeps the legions away from the Rhine.
And if Arminius hadn't had this stunning initial success, like the Arminian revolt is really one thing, right? Or that's what we know it for, right? That's the horror. I've angered Lindsay. Let me shut up before I say things. But there's an initial explosive success which causes, like, you can feel this cultural trauma. I would liken it to the defeat at the Alia in 390, right? Like, this is a thing that sits with Rome, scares the crap out of everybody, and that, like, has this resonance to it that I think overshadows the actual strategic impact of the revolt itself. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, let's remember that what Rome lost was territory. It lost land, and a lot of land. So, for example, basically you can shade the area from basically Vetera, which is part of the story that Mark writes about, all the way up to the Hunneberg and all the rest, all the way to the shores of the North Sea, as it were, right across potentially to the Elbe. So, for example, you've got there a series of rivers that basically divides sort of northwest Germany. But the point is, all of that is lost, right? All of the work of two and a half decades to conquer it is lost in the space of 2 weeks or something like this. And Tiberius agrees with Germanicus to let him have a go and get some honor back. I don't know whether it's quite clear as to whether the intention is to get the territory back. He just basically wants Arminius and make him account for it. But in the end, Tiberius decides to abandon it. So that had real cost for them, whereas the Batavian revolt didn't really involve any land. So I think I would have to say it must be Arminius.
I think there wouldn't be danger, though. That would be cost. You know, which was the most expensive to Rome? I think the Arminian revolt was more expensive.
The Arminian revolt is three legions destroyed permanently. Batavian revolt, Prima Germanica is lost or never
restored? No, I believe it was disbanded afterward because of its poor showing.
Tullius Cariolis brings it back into the fold, and then later on in his reorganization.
The fifth Alaudae disappears
eventually.
It's all unclear.
But I would argue, in terms of the legions, that actually the revolt that actually is the most dangerous, potentially, it doesn't see it through, but potentially is actually the Germanic revolt in between the Batavian revolt, in terms of this declaration of the Gallic Empire, and the fact that you've got two legions who switch sides and go to this new rebel empire. You've got two other legions. I mean, that's the first legion and 16th legion go over and join, and they are then underutilized, which is the major mistake of this new empire. They don't utilize and capitalize on that. You also have two legions, the legions that were in Vetera hold up in there for the various sieges, actually decide they've had enough and volunteer to go out, and again another mistake is made by this new empire that they can't control the Germanic troops that they've got under their wing, and of course these Germanic troops turn on the two legions coming out of Vetera, massacre half of them, which actually, you know, seeing as there was only 5,000 troops amongst the two legions in the first place, doesn't leave much, but what's left of them go back into Vetera. I mean, you know, if somebody, you know, with his head screwed on would have been in charge of that, you know, rebel empire, I mean, you've got Sabinus decides that he's going to go off and immediately conquer more Gallic tribes who haven't agreed to his terms. You've got others chasing personal vendettas across Gaul and up into Belgium. if somebody actually capitalized on saying those legions are actually willing to come over to our side, we could actually use this, you know, what starts with four could develop further. That would have been.
It always comes down to leadership, doesn't it? You have a poor leader and the thing doesn't go. But I was going to say.
But maybe you should clarify, maybe, Mark, that you know, it starts with the Batavians and they get allies, some of whom sort of limit themselves to the Batavian campaign, like the Kaninafats.
Yeah.
And then further south, what is now Belgium and France, more and more tribes revolt and they go their own way and you get this Sabinus guy.
I'm going to throw in another bigger picture. I'm going to throw in another bigger picture. By losing the German territories, it set up Rome for the next two centuries of barbarian invasions, right? Which ultimately destroyed the Western Roman Empire. So if you know, sort of alternate history.
That's about 15 other podcasts, Lindsay.
No. But all I'm saying is what we're trying to work out here is the theoretical, you know, which is more important or more devastating the other one. And what I'm saying is, I think if you do the calculus, if you do the logical extension of what the total cost of ownership, as it were, would be, I think you have to conclude it's the Arminian revolt, because what it means is that the loss of Germany exposes that whole frontier to a great many things which will cost Rome in the end.
I think the problem is it's chaos theory, because something was happening 500 BC, which would eventually lead to the population pressure by the Huns pushing tribes. Yeah, but, you know, whether they invaded the Roman Empire across the Elbe or the Rhine wouldn't have made any difference, because they were still coming, and they had been coming for hundreds of years prior to when they cross in 376. So, you know, I was just going to come back to Mike's point about the fact that even the Batavian revolt talks about that there are some tribes that remain loyal to Rome, even with all of their neighbors revolting and joining Civilis, but there are still, you know, auxilia tribes who remain loyal to Rome because of their loyalty to that idea of, you know, Civitas and Romanitas. So it's still the same thing that we saw in the previous century.
I think that the Arminian revolt had the potential to be much more damaging. As damaging as it was, three legions destroyed all at once, because it tore a gap in Rome's defenses along the Rhine that could have been exploited. The furor in Rome was palpable. It was enormous. That it did not become worse, I think, had more to do with Roman luck. And I think that the problem that the Romans had during the Batavian revolt, that was a bad thing piled up on a much worse thing, the Civil War. So I think that the Arminian revolt was worse because of its potentiality.
Let's leave it to our Patreon members to make the ultimate decision, perhaps.
I think we'll leave it at that. Unless anybody has any last quips or additions, then I'll see you again next time. Thank you all very much.